This is Joe Leith at the 1971 Midland Winter Conference in Midland, Texas, chaired by Chuck Chamberlain.
I met Joe, I think, for the first time, as I remembered, in about 1954 or 56, in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we have met all over the country since, time after time. But it hasn't been enough. I came all the way down here from California at my own expense. Let me say that again. I don't think you heard me. All the way down here at my own expense. Just to do what I'm doing right now. Introducing my boy Joe. He is unique in the annals of our society. We had a guy up here last night for a little while and this afternoon for a little while. That's unique also. There's just one Clancy on earth. And that's almost too many. No, it isn't, is it? We're very happy to have Clancy in our area. Anybody that won't listen to me will listen to Clancy. So we're glad to have him. But this next one is unique also. In that there isn't anybody that I've ever heard talk about Alcoholics Anonymous that can express himself so uniquely as Joe. I don't care whether he's serious or funny or just straight down the middle of the road or around with the cats. He laughs. I love to hear him, and I know you're going to love to hear him. I give you Joe from Texas. Joe the Wino from Tyler, Texas.
My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd love to take that introduction and have it imprinted upon my tombstone in one long sentence. And maybe some later date a tired pigeon could stop there and... he could punctuate it where it needed. This has been a wonderful conference. As Chuck so graphically pointed out, it's been a little unbalanced, I think. We got five noble Californians and me and Super Jew. If you don't think we can hold up our end. Say the least, I'm underwhelmed. Well, that's not right. Clancy will check me. But we've had some... This has been one of the greatest experiences in my life, really. And this is not table talk. I don't know of how you could put a thing together with as much power and momentum as this has been. To sit and enjoy seeing the thing that the rest of society possibly will never see. And as Chuck said the other night, we may be the last stronghold of reasoning in a society that seems to be falling apart at our shoulders. And to say the least, we can see a thing nobody else gets to see. And that's the efficacy of God's handiwork. And the fellas that don't deserve it. And for this, I'm indeed grateful. Now, everybody preceding me has told a beautiful and cherishing story about their recovery. I think if we ever leave this pattern in Alcoholics Anonymous, we'd be dead. I wonder if you could remember a little with me about the first fellow that ever told his story to another man. Do you know that he had to ask permission to tell it? And very frequently I hear people get up here and say, I don't want to talk about my drinking. And this is what I must talk about. The book reads, and the little doctor, and the doctor's opinion in our book of experience. And it tells in his experience, and I don't think there's a greater piece of writing on paper today. And I'm an English major, too. I've read all the writings of one Shakespeare. Read about the meanderings of an itinerant fisherman named Simon Peter. All of the greatest works of Plato and Aristotle. And if you're in the business of saving your own life, you'll never read nothing like the book Alcoholics Anonymous. To show you how brilliant I am, so that there won't be any doubt when you leave tonight, let me tell you a little about this book. It was written with a given purpose. We who live in this day and age, and not for long, I'm afraid, some of us have had the privilege of knowing the author real close. And he told me one day why this book was written. And they discovered that they had a thing, and I love to call it a thing, that would work. Up until the little doctor saw Bill with his first experience, he was the first Al-Anon, if you ask me, and he was a man that worked diligently with alcoholics, many thousands of them, and never saw a recovery. Don't you know this was a lonesome and futile thing that the little doctor saw? Never a recovery. Every time he treated a man, he could say to himself, I'll fix you up so you can come back again. Mary, they got half answers. And then one day it happened. And he had the privilege of seeing the first one of us sober up. And if you take these two pages in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, he mentions in there a thing that some of us don't ever talk about, and that's the phenomenon of craving. He mentions it five times in three pages. The phenomenon of craving. And he tells what he thinks from observation, gives the greatest dissertation that's ever been known. about the true nature of our disease. And he does in two paragraphs the whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous from the beginning to the end. Bill takes 186 pages, but the little doctor took two paragraphs in the summarization. Now, the book has 186 pages, 11 chapters. It's written backwards. They tell you about the solution before they tell you about the problem. You know that? And when he gets nearly through writing the book, he admits in the 11th chapter he don't know a whole lot about what he's taught. If this is not the essence of humility, I don't know. He says, we know very little, but we hope that God will reveal more to us. And it brings me to the point that I have to say that I'm sick of experts. But we don't have to worry about them people in with that $398 million. We're going to have to watch these nuts we got in AA, not the ones out of it. With all of their extraneous, the good word. With all of their extraneous and extracurricular activities, they've got groups 3AA and Pie in the Sky and Under. I belong to a group down in Tyler, and we call it the Under 85 group. And we had to throw an old fella out the other day. We couldn't force him into AA menopause, I guess. I don't. And as we pushed him out the door, he stoutly maintained that his disease was the same after 85 as it was before. These are the things that frighten me, is when I run into an expert on alcoholism. So that's the reason I'm here tonight. So you can hear an expert. No, I'm kidding. I know so very little about it. But I've heard so many people say from the podium that you can't put any price tag on AA. Ain't nothing you can put on it. Let's see if we can't. Pick a figure somewhere. Let's take $398 million. I wonder if you can spend that money in any way on earth. Who have seen what we've seen here since Thursday night. And a pity the poor folks that have to use it, because they're going to, there's an old myth that says that if you would destroy a man, give him everything he wants. And sooner or later in their study of us, they're going to run into a thing called God, inevitably, and to study about God without having an experience is a horrible thing. So you see, the old prophet in the Testament was quite right when he said that if what they do is of the Lord, you can't destroy it. But if what they do is not of the Lord, they will destroy themselves. There's also another old Hebrew saying that if the camel gets his head in the tent, his body is soon to follow. Some of Homer's leftover notes. Let's don't be serious too much longer. Mary, Mary told us this evening that AA gave us the privilege of laughing and crying, shedding a tear. And I think that I've never seen an alcoholic that somewhere within the scope of his whole makeup was not a laughing spirit, that was tied down and never let go until he found the way of expression in Alcoholics Anonymous. So let's don't mourn the past. Let's laugh a little, if we can, at me. Because this was a thing that he couldn't do till he found AA. Couldn't laugh at me. But it seems to me that everywhere I go, I run into people want us to conform. You know, they used to say to me, "Why don't you drink like he does?" And I said, "Well, why don't he drink like I do?" That makes just as much sense. I talked about it here last year, a little preparation called Preparation H. None of you know what that is. And I went into the drugstore the other day and they said to this very floozy young fella behind the counter, he was real pretty. And I said, "Would you give me a package of Preparation H?" And he said, "Yes, walk this way." And I said, "If it could walk that way, I wouldn't need it." Privilege throwing away the sham of falsity and inhumanity. And people say to me, "What do you talk about in AA?" Well, hell, everything. Anything we want to, and we know nobody's going to laugh at us. Yesterday afternoon, we sat in the, over here in the Reluctant Cockroach. Hey, that's the place, boy. We've been laying over there listening to the plumbing gurgle. And whoever painted it did, they painted right over the cockroaches. And when that plaster starts walking off and leaving here, in a hell of a fit. We talk about many things. We sit over there yesterday and Johnny told us a beautiful story about his pet turtle. Well, he couldn't tell that to anybody but a bunch of drunks because they'd laugh at him. And he had us all on his side. It was a beautiful story. This is what it takes to make AA. And we sit and talk about it. Chuck and I were driving out to Terminal Island one night out in California, and sitting there talking, and we laughed. I left to aggravate him for some reason or other. He just... And I asked him, I said, "Chuck, did you ever get so nervous that you lay down on the bed and you could hear your hair grow?" Well, the average lay crowd wouldn't laugh at that, you know. Nothing funny about it. We do. Have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Let that roll around. God damn you. Yes. You ever been run over by your own car? While driving. Have you ever been locked up out of jail? I have. Man up in Roseville, California, the chief of police. I got in there late in the afternoon. And they had those beautiful clean sheets. My God, I wanted to sleep. And as they shook me down, the little sergeant, he's taking the stuff out of my pockets. In came the chief. And he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm putting him in jail." He said, "No, you're not either." He said, "He's too untidy." These are the things that we talk about. We know nobody won't laugh at it. Because it's happened to you. And I think that the thing that makes it easy to talk about is the fact that now is as good a time as any. Everybody wants me to tell about them damn cats of Mary. And this I tell with a purpose. Icky Sheriff, who's dead now, bless his heart. Some of you old members remember Icky. And Icky used to say, if you can smell yourself, other folks been smelling you 3 days. Simply for the purpose that the little doctor says in here about an alcoholic. And them goddamn psychiatrists had me convinced that it was because my mama put me on the pot backwards. You and me, essentially, because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Ain't nothing hard about that, is it? I told the guy, if you have some deep-seated tendencies to become a horse's ass. You'll become full of bone. Okay. But the little doctor says here, men and women like the effect produced by alcohol. Then it begins to get into a little deeper water, and he says the sensation is so elusive that while they see others drinking with impunity, after a time, it's kind of like it says in the scripture, and it came to pass, you know. After a time, they cannot differentiate. Next sentence is where it takes your britches off. It says, the alcoholic gets to thinking. And this is dangerous as hell. Can't you see what it's done to claim? How about that? And then the first thing we want to do when we get to AA is educate her. And when you put your arm around one of them stinking old drunks like Mary did, he don't know how he felt. And you're not aware how he smelled either. So I'll tell you about the cat. We've always had cats, Mary and I. Some pretty good cats and some not so good cats. We just treat things. And Mary had to go up into Illinois, one of her needed a little help. And she left me and the cats at home. And I had to load up and go home to Mama. This was always headquarters just after being fired. So I loaded the cats, two cats, in the back of the car, east to Tyler. And I got to Houston. I bought the 3 pints for the price of 2, and as I remember it, it was a cool night, and the windows were frosted up, just a pleasant evening. And as I drove along, I drank and sang a little, and boy promised me, you know. This great feeling of well-being that we have. Driving along. None of you ever done that, haven't you? And I got to little town up in Cleveland, Texas, and got out to get a chaser for one of these 3 pints. When did the damn cats got out? And the new didn't dare show up at home to Mary without them cats. So here I'm half drunk to run all over this little town in the rain and the mud and finally treed that cat up under a cotton gin down there and picked him up by one of his hind legs and whipped him all the way back to the car. And threw him in the back seat, and he did a thing in that back seat. Wasn't nice. Sort of, kind of like one of Picasso's studies in brown. Didn't bother me. Crawled right in, drove right on, took another honk on that jug, sang a little more. Oh, promise me. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I threw up in the front seat. Never stopped to sing. And as it was breaking day, drove into a little town called Alto, Texas, one long main street, a couple of dim street lights burning there, and I pulled over to the side to get the cap off of this jug and take a little honk there. And there was a town clown, a constable, I think he was, or a sheriff or something, and it must have been his first chance to make an arrest in years. And he came walking up to the side of the car and rapped on that glass and he said, "Let that window down." The window down, he said, "What do you think, Carol? Oh my God." Say to you, that when you put your arm around his neck, tell him you love him and you want to help him, he don't really know how I feel, does he? He can't tell the truth from the false. He thinks that his life is the only normal one. So let's not grow away from him with intellect. See if we can separate the truth from the false. I drank. It's been rumored here that I was one of them things that they make out in California. They call them a wino. This is a rather delicate thing. I don't like to talk about it too much. Particularly this close to home. But you can't cuss that wine too much. It's a wonderful thing, wine is. I think it has some wonderful medicinal purposes, wine does. It will absolutely cure hay fever. If you drink it like I did, you ain't gonna call. Not even a little sneeze, you ain't gonna take, is it? Now, if you folks, any of you here studying me tonight, don't look too close. You'll find hidden behind, but I didn't use enough poly grip tonight. You'll find beneath this arrogant facade a very intelligent individual. What he used to tell him at the police station. And I appreciated what Mary said and heard Chuck say it many times before. And we sit around AA and console ourselves about the keen alcoholic mind. And this is the only place you'll ever hear about it. I never have been to a seminar on keen alcoholic minds anyway. Outside. Not so long ago I attended the sales meeting and we had for our guest this gal, what's her name, Ann Landers, who writes Dear Abby, is that what it is? And she was doing a little answering question thing. When it was over, we was all having a rather informal meeting and she told of a very amusing letter that she had received. And it went something like this. Said, Dear Ann, me and my husband have been married for 26 years. And said, on our anniversary, said, I was hoping that he'd buy me a Singer sewing machine. And said he up and bought me a cemetery plot. What would you do, you know? And she thought, she didn't know what to answer for the letter, and she thought in a moment of whimsy to send it to the Singer sewing machine people. And they took it, and this is the letter that they wrote back to the old woman. Said, Dear Miss So-and-so, said, we understand that your husband bought you a cemetery lot instead of that Singer sewing machine, and said, we'll gladly trade it to you. We'll give you the sewing machine for your cemetery lot because we suspect that we have a dead salesman in your area. Well, I'll tell you a little about my drinking just to qualify myself, if I haven't already. But I drank at the tender age of 17. Not for escape, because I essentially like the effect produced by alcohol. And with my first drink, it was an alcoholic, I guess. I got drunk the first time I drank alcohol. And 18 and a half years later, I got drunk with the last drink of alcohol. And with all the drinks in between, I got drunk. Now, you can call that whatever you want to. I just never did have any luck with drinking. I was, they say that the practice makes perfect. But I practiced the art and never gained any proficiency at it at all. So I continued to improve worse. I did. And it came to my mind, suddenly, the first time it ever bothered me, I had migrated to Southern California and had moved to Hollywood. An East Texas country boy, and chose for all the professions on the face of the earth to go into designing ladies' lingerie. Now this is a very nice profession. You work with models and a lot of fun. We have a step in AA called the second step, and it refers to our sanity. Kind of infers there that we drunks may have a gopher in the garden. And the drunks don't like that. We don't like to be unsmart. But let me tell you something. My business was cutting brassieres. And if you cut a bunch of brassieres with three of them places in them, you're nuts. I told the psychiatrist about that, and he said it was just wishful thinking. Needless to say, I cut myself out of that profession. Come out, worked for a Jewish fella, a nice fella there, and he was a highly compassionate man. He didn't understand why he could drink and I couldn't. He was the first man that brought my disease face to face with me. And he said, "Joe, you can't drink." In those few words. And I remember how mad it made me, how I got so upset there. I was kind of delicate anyway. "You can't drink." And he said, "I'm going to have to get rid of you. You're costing us too much money." And then in an aside, his face lit up, and he said, "I've got one thing to be thankful for." He said, "I'm glad that you weren't a rabbi, because the way you handle them scissors, you'd have destroyed our whole race." Charlotte. I'd like to say to you today, for whatever it's worth, any of you folks coming in today, I left here, yeah, I come today and say, "Hey, I've got to quit drinking, I'm going to lose my job." Well, if it's bothering you drinking, you need to quit it. I'm going to have to quit drinking, and my wife's going to leave me. Well, quit her. Don't leave the drinking. She's getting in your way. So I got another job down in the shipyard in those days. The war was going on, and I was not one of the fellas that helped win it. And I went down and literally bought a plumber's license out the back door of a union hall in San Pedro, and I went into the shipyard as a master plumber. This is a fellow that had never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors, and I was a master frog. And in those days, if some of you can remember this, and I'm sure Mary can, you were frozen to your job. God almighty. But I thawed out. I have a little piece of paper that hangs in my den now, a little pink memento, and it's signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles.
This is where the executive comes out in us, and we say to our wives, you better go get a job because I can't. This is a built-in thing there, and Mary was very proficient at a lot of things. And we went through these years of making excuses. The sickness is beginning to show. We moved up into Northern California and didn't have a choice of a lot of things to do, and I went to work, of all things, for the railroad up there. And I'd love to say here they were the narrow-mindedest bunch of folks I ever saw in my life. They had a rule against drinking. And the rule read that if you were seen coming out of an establishment to dispense alcoholic beverages, you could be fired. Well, I never came out very often. And if I did, it was under duress and coercion. But then the excuses. This is where the poor Al-Anon comes in. You hear the fellas stand up behind these podiums and beat their gums and say, I wonder how I live long enough to get into AA. I wonder how they live that long. Chiseling away at you and chipping at you all the time. Hitting the bed with that goddamn vacuum sweeper. And he called us and I went. And I felt so good. I got another buddy of mine to go with me in my nice new automobile, which was a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we go down and snare the drunk, get him out of the bar, get his jug back, and we put him between us. And I began to give him the pitch. And to say the least, it was a picture in sheer eloquence. And as I drove and slowly talked to the drunk, I remember how good I felt. And I looked over at him and his eyes had begun to water and I thought, I'm getting him. And after a few more of my very eloquent observations, he gently lay his head over on my shoulder. And I knew had him. Did you ever hear of anybody throwing up silently? Every time I've ever gotten godlike with a drunk, he pukes on me. Another little lesson in this society of ours, and that's when you give up on one. He ain't ready, we say. I don't know, the book doesn't really set a date on how long you're supposed to work with a drunk. I worked with one for 4.5 years. The first time I saw him, my wife took the call and I went. And he was a fella, looked about like I did when I came, scurvy as hell, smelled like a goat, virgin on DTs. And I borrowed a goblet of whiskey and poured it down him, and it knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshuckled from his drink, he was in an AA club. I believe any way you get him there is good. And he got sober. And he stayed sober for 3 months. And he got drunk. And it was a blow to my ego. I said to myself, he can't help but get sober under my direction.
Then I went and got him again. 3 months and he's drunk again. And he had a little affliction that I know none of you've ever had. He'd go to faraway places and call me Colette. Just to tell me that he was drunk. And I prayed about him. I made him a sort of a side project, and I'd pray about him. I'd say, God, you've been watching them sparrows too much to let me have this one. I'll have it. But it kept it going. And about 9 years ago, we got on for him what I hope was his last drunk in one of our local motels. And he called another fella from our club who's not half as smart as I am. And he went out and talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he's been sober ever since. And I hated his guts. And I'd sit in the club and look at him, and I'd think, you ought to be mine. And if I know anything of the treasure that God's given us, if I know anything about God's love at all from my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that I owe him more than he owes me. He kept me sober for 4.5 damn years. I don't know what to tell you. I'm not too highbrow about God's work. I have to leave that to some of my betters. All I know is I gotta watch what I see. So before I sit down, I'll tell you a little story about a fella calling on a sick guy. The only way I know to do it. The only difference in the trip to see the sick fella and one of our trips to see a sick fella is that it happened 2,000 years ago. And this is the story that may or may not be well known in the scripture about the fella that they call the demoniac. And it's written by a doctor, very coldly and abstractly, he wrote what he saw. They called this fellow a maniac full of demons. This was their description in those days. He was a demoniac. For the lack of better verbiage. If some of these smart cats could have analyzed him today, he would have been a schizophrenic or a bedwetter or something like that. But in those days, they weren't so intellectual. He was a demoniac. We let it go at that. And he was sicker than hell. And it says in there, verbatim, that he was so wild that no man could tame him. Unlike me and you. And it says that the manifestations of his disease, believe you, were such that they had to run him out of town. Kind of like me. And they ran him out on the riverbank, and he was out there eating with some pigs. A babbling idiot. Kind of like me and you. If you got any imagination at all, you can see that picture. You can smell it, and you can hear it. The babbling of a sick man. And it seemed to have been at that time a little carpenter fella who was going to and fro teaching a new philosophy of love. And the little carpenter fella had a facility that you and I haven't quite acquired yet. He could see no ill in anyone with any cat. So he goes to see this cat on the riverbank, and he says to him, "Say, feller, are you having any trouble?" And this old boy just eat up with self-pity. And he said, "Yes, that's my name. They call me Legion, which means many. I just eat up with trouble." And the little carpenter knew he needed some help, and he was willing to give it, so they asked him. And he went through a queer process of it was real strange manner in which you heal the demoniac. It was a matter of getting some spirits out of him into some pigs. And the folks in those days understood it less than they understand ours today. How about that? And some stool pigeon run into town and told these people that you're out of the pig business. But the old boy was getting well. These people came out of town, you know, they heard this out of the pig business, and they go out there, and here's what I like about the whole story. We got a step, the second one, it says something about returning to sanity. And it says, when they got there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. Fully clothed and in his right mind. And the people weren't interested in one fella getting well. They was interested in the loss of the pig. Wasn't the least bit concerned with the one fella getting well. By God, you and me better be interested in him in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because this ain't a wholesale business. When you see one man sober in the back seat of an AA club, you better well be sure that another one man is sitting with him for a lot of hours. We'll never do it wholesale, or it won't be as good as it is tonight. So the folks that saw the man get well, they had prevailed upon him to leave. Get out of here. Get out. Get from here. And I can well see the little fellow who had come from one life into another and didn't know how to act in the new. He was filled with fright like I was the night when I came. I had to turn to my sponsor for everything I needed. And he turned to the little carpenter and he said in sheer fright, in sheer helplessness, "Will you let me go with you?" And the little carpenter broke a rule. Everybody that he'd ever helped before that, he said to them, "Go on, don't say anything about this now. Don't tell anybody. Just keep it to yourself." And he gave that feller an admonishment that I would give to you, friend. When he said to him, "No, I won't take you with me. Stay here so that others can see what has happened to you." Thank you.
Fortunate can we be? I can't keep from thinking about the three guys that were walking down the road when that carpenter was around. Pretty soon they were joined by a fourth. And they walked together for a while, and then the fourth guy disappeared. And they fell to talking about it. And this was the thing that they came up with. They said, "Didn't our hearts burn within us as he walked with us and talked with us by the wayside?"